Thursday, March the 10th, and we have a very full agenda, so we're going to get started. Quorum is present. First order of business is the minutes from Thursday, March 5th, which are in your packets. Do I have a motion? Representative Curran?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Curran moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes approved. Thank you. So the next, I'm going to read the safety notices for the committee. So to ensure a productive and safe environment where everyone can follow the proceedings, we ask all attendees to maintain a high standard of decorum here in the committee room. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Please refrain from applause and other audible demonstrations. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior are not permitted. To ensure we get to hear from everyone, testifiers should limit their remarks to the specified time, and if we didn't give you a time, please be as concise as you can. For safety reasons, do not sit or stand in the aisles. If you need seating accommodations, please alert the sergeant staff wearing the gold ties. If you were issued an entrance ticket, please keep it. You may need it for re-entry if you leave the room. The state troopers and sergeant staff are stationed throughout the room to ensure the safety of all participants. Thank you, everybody. So, having gotten that out of the way, the next thing is we have a new member on the committee, and I would like to welcome Representative Van Binsbergen to the Judiciary Committee, and welcome Representative Van Binsbergen, I'll get it, and I'd like to give you a moment, if you choose to just introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's great to be here today and looking forward to serving on this committee. I represent House District 16A, which is west of here, about 2 hours. Represent communities like Litchfield, Olivia, and Montevideo. So looking forward to joining this committee.
All right. Well, thank you. Welcome. So the first bill on the agenda for today is House File 2354, Representative Norris. And since he's not in the committee, I will move the bill to be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Is that correct, Representative Norris?
That is correct, Chair Liebling.
All right. With that, Representative Norris, please go ahead and present your bill.
Great. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Like so many Minnesotans, I am furious about fraud. And it's why I introduced this bill last year to beef up the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. This bill had bipartisan support and passed out of the House last year, but got stuck in the Senate. So we're back with an updated bill, hoping to get it passed into law to meet the moment for Minnesotans. Medical assistance fraud steals from hardworking taxpayers across Minnesota. It also steals money meant to provide health care to low-income Minnesotans. That's disgraceful, and we're here to help crack down on this type of fraud. This bill does what Minnesotans expect us to do, enhance our ability to investigate fraud and stiffen penalties for those who steal from government programs. Simply put, this bill supports the work of catching people who steal from medical assistance and making sure that they are held accountable. And with that, Chair Liebling, I'm pleased to have Attorney General Ellison with me, along with Mr. Wonka from his office, and they'll explain a little bit more about the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and the provisions of this bill that apply to this committee.
Thank you. Welcome, Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Liebling, and thank you, Co-Chair Scott. Appreciate y'all both and all members of the committee. We're here today to talk about the amended version of the Medical Assistance Protection Act, MAP Act. I want to thank you, Representative Matt Norris, for being our House author. And I also want to introduce everybody to Mr. Nick Wonka, who is the Director of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in my office. As you know, medical assistance is Minnesota's name for Medicaid. Again, Matt Norris and Senator Ann Johnson Stewart have introduced this bill in the House and in the Senate, and I want to thank the bipartisan support that we've seen so far. I believe this bill is absolutely essential to the work to protect the public dollar in Minnesota, this bill this year is amended to better fight the cause of preventing Medicaid fraud and to holding those accountable who commit it. because of the moment we're in calls on us to do much more. The MAP Act adds 18 dedicated specialized staff to our Medicaid fraud control unit, bringing the number from 32 to 50. It's important to make this very clear to everyone on the committee. Minnesota only pays for one quarter of the program. This is very important to make clear to everyone. We're not asking you to fund 18 new FTEs. We're asking you to fund 25% of that. The federal government pays 75% of that. And this is a program you should know. Every single state attorney's general office has its program. It is in Texas. It's in Pennsylvania. It's in Idaho. And it's in Minnesota. The match program, the 25% we put up, allows us to be able to have the staff level we need to be effective in the fight against Medicaid fraud. And you should know that CMS in Washington does annual audits for the program and have assessed that two things. One is that Minnesota's Medicaid Control Fraud Unit in the Attorney General's office is actually punching above its weight. We've convicted over 300 people since I've been the AG, and over 80 million in recovery in terms of restitution, fines, and things like that. And yet, although we're fifth or sixth in the country, that's comparing us with states that are significantly bigger, Texas, California. And so what the CMS authorities who've done the audits have said is that you need to get bigger in order to meet the need of the moment, but that means Minnesota has to provide that 25% match. So for the price of one fraud fighter, Minnesota gets three more. It is important to just point out that this match program, if the match does not, is that the match would be for the Attorney General's office. The federal program is set up that way. So for another state agency, it wouldn't work. So sending the money to, for example, the BCA would not meet the needs of the grant. So just for your edification, I share that. Now, I'd just like to talk about some improvements in the bill that we want to share with you. Number one, the MAP Act 2.0, because we went through last year. Thank you, House, for passing it through. We'll close some of the legal loopholes that have allowed some fraudsters to avoid accountability and to add more legal tools to help Minnesota better investigate and prosecute major fraud schemes. The MAP Act will also equalize penalties for fraud. Right now, penalties for stealing from a private entity are higher than stealing from the government. The bill will fix that. And then three, if you steal $36 million from the Medicaid fraud program, you are subject to the same penalty as if you stole $36,000. And we need to, that's why we're asking you to increase the penalties so that we can make sure that they're commensurate with the level of wrongdoing. Our bill creates new penalties for Medicaid fraud over $100,000 and over $1 million. So the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, MFCU, we call it MFUCU, that's our shorthand, is actually one of the best in the nation. That's federal assessment. That's not me bragging. That's the Fed's assessment of the entire program. And we look forward to working with every member in this committee in order to protect public resources for people who need them. And with your permission, Madam Chair and Co-Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Nick Wonka to elaborate. He is the career prosecutor who leads the program.
Thank you, Attorney General. Mr. Wonka, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead and give us your testimony.
I'm Nick Wonka, N-I-C-K-W-A-N-K-A. I'm the director of the Medicaid Fraud Unit. Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I'd like to elaborate on just a couple points the Attorney General made about the specific pieces here that are within your jurisdiction, those being the subpoena authority in Minnesota Statute 816, the legal representation in 256B12, and the venue and restitution provisions in 609-467. First, the subpoena authority in Section 1. The MAP Act seeks to supplement the Attorney General's subpoena power in that statute. The additions are limited to Medicaid provider fraud investigations when it comes to the financial records that we would conduct right now under Minnesota Statute 256B12. They would allow the Medicaid Fraud Unit to obtain the contents of financial accounts when we are investigating a Medicaid provider for fraud. At present, Minnesota County attorneys have the authority to subpoena financial records under Minnesota Statute 38823. The Minnesota Department of Human Services also has the authority to subpoena financial records when they're conducting administrative investigations. And federal law enforcement and prosecutors have the ability to issue grand jury subpoenas for financial information. The addition sought here in the MAP Act would align the Attorney General's authority in its civil and criminal Medicaid provider fraud investigations with that of DHS and county attorneys and federal prosecuting authorities. It does not allow us more power than others, but ensures that we do not continue to have less. And it will help ensure that we have the same authority to investigate providers who defraud Medicaid as county attorneys have when they investigate recipients who inflate their income or assets to wrongfully obtain benefits. Next, the legal representation piece in Section 2. Right now, Minnesota Statute 256B12 provides the Attorney General's office with original jurisdiction to prosecute Medicaid provider fraud. This distinguishes Medicaid provider fraud from all other criminal offenses, which ordinarily require a county attorney referral under Minnesota Statute 801. Recodifying the medical assistance fraud statute from Minnesota Statute 609466, which is what it is now, to 609467, which it would be in the MAP Act, requires the conforming change to 256B12 to ensure the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit retains jurisdiction to prosecute provider fraud offenses in state courts. Next, the venue provisions in Section 3, Subdivision 5. This provision is captured from other statutes, most prominently our theft statutes in Minnesota Statute 60952, Subdivision 5, and the venue provisions in other financial crimes, like financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. It allows us clear ability to charge in specific counties where any part of the offense occurred or where a claim for reimbursement or payment was received. Many times our cases span multiple counties, and this permits charging in any county where the specific activity delineated in statute occurs. Finally, the restitution provision. This will permit capturing more fraudulently obtained funds in restitution than the law permits right now. What it does is allow the court to order restitution for conduct that is part of the same scheme charged in the complaint, but that which is not specifically contained in a charged criminal count. Right now, case law from our appellate court says the restitution may only be ordered for the conduct that makes up a conviction. This statute will allow district courts to award restitution for all related conduct, even if it's not a direct part of the conviction, so long as the state gives notice that it intends to seek this restitution. An offender would still be allowed to challenge restitution as they are now, and the burden would still be on the state in any restitution hearing, but it would allow the state to recapture fraudulently taken Medicaid funds in a more efficient and better manner than it does now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wonka. There was an A6 amendment posted, but it has been withdrawn and will not be offered. Does any member of the public wish to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone. So with that, we can move to member questions. Thank you. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. Thank you for being here, Attorney General. When I ask you a question, I believe that there are over 50 lawsuits that have been filed against the Trump administration as of early 2026, January. Does that sound about correct?
Yes.
Attorney General. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Madam Chair, yes, it does.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so why not simply prioritize the resources and time, manpower, towards additional Medicaid fraud cases rather than continue to use those resources against the Trump administration?
Attorney General.
Thank you for the question. Because the nature of the grant is that the federal grant and the way it works all over the country, not just here, is that the state puts up a fixed amount of money for the program, and then the federal government will match it. If you are in the Medicaid control fraud unit, that's the unit you're in. We don't have people jumping from consumer to Medicaid fraud. They stay in Medicaid fraud because of the dedicated nature of the program. I would point out that the that we've recovered about $4.3 billion or more because we've challenged the Trump administration, including the tariff case that, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that we were right and the Trump administration was incorrect in its assumption that it could simply raise tariffs without the benefit of Congress or a legitimate emergency. So it's not like we're just suing the Trump administration just to be suing them. We've won about more than 80% of the time that we've been in court because, again, of federalism. The U.S. Constitution, 10th Amendment, says that the federal government gets to control certain things and is supreme in those things. Other things, they're not. They're left to the state. And on the basis of that, conservative, centrist, liberal courts, all of the above, have ruled in our favor consistently.
Thank you. Representative Engen, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about fraud. It might be a day late or 6-7 years too late and $9 billion short, but I do appreciate that you're all of a sudden recognizing how big of a deal this is. But can every member of this committee be rest assured that you're going to be fighting with these resources, this $1.23 million, should this bill pass? You're going to be using those resources to fight against fraudsters rather than for them.
Attorney General.
Madam Chair, I understand the political nature of the question you're asking. I choose to simply answer the question this way. You can rest assured that we have been and will continue to be fighting fraudsters and putting them in prison, as we have convicted over 300 people since I've been the Attorney General. And let me just say this so you know. I know that when I put my name on a lawn sign, there's a D, not an R. I get it. I understand politics is reality. But the Medicaid Control Fraud Unit has nothing to do with that. I have no idea who he voted for. I don't care. I ask him not to tell me because it doesn't matter. What matters is programs that are designed to help people who need help are being stolen from, and those people need to be taken down. So I get what's going on here, but I'm telling everybody this is the least political part of my office. They really have nothing to do with it. We get referrals from the agency. This is suspected fraud, and Nick prosecutes them with his team, and that's how it works. I've never ever, and I can tell you, I can assure you this, said, you know, anything remotely political, but I do understand what part of what we're doing here. I will also assure you there's nothing political about this unit at all.
All right, Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Attorney General Ellison, so is there any sworn law enforcement officers in your office?
I'll hand that one to Mr. Wonka.
Mr. Wonka.
We do not currently have sworn officers. We have many former sworn officers who work as investigators.
Representative Steer.
All right. So at what point do you need to get a sworn law enforcement officer involved in the investigation? I assume that going out into the field and executing search warrants, that would be local or state law enforcement. Do they have to sign the complaint? Walk me through that process of you do the investigation, you find out who the person is, at what point do you turn it over to law enforcement, and then where do you go from there?
Mr. Wonka.
So we don't turn it over to law enforcement in that sense. Our investigators can be affiants on search warrants, and they can be affiants on complaints, and they are. That's how this works. We work often with sworn law enforcement when we execute a premises search warrant. They carry firearms. We don't, so they can secure the scene. And the statute does require a sworn peace officer to actually serve the warrant. So when we're going to a business, we will have, sometimes it's BCA, sometimes it's local law enforcement. They will come in with us. They will enter the premises. They will serve the warrant. They will secure the scene. And then our investigators go in and seize the evidence, conduct the interviews in the field. We don't need sworn officers to do that. If there's a safety concern, we will go with either state or federal law enforcement sometimes, if we're working jointly with them, to do an interview in someone's house. But ordinarily, the day-to-day, it's just our investigators are knocking and talking on people's doors.
Representative Steer.
All right. So I'm just, I mean, the question that I posed at the beginning was, why would this money be funneled to the Attorney General's office and not into the BCA? And I think that question was answered. I'm going to verify that. I'm not saying that you didn't tell the truth, but I just think that it would be better to start it with law enforcement, and then once the case is done, then we hand it to the Attorney General's office for prosecution. It just makes more sense to me. We cut out the start of this, have local law enforcement, state law enforcement do it, the BCA, the fraud unit. I believe that's why the governor moved the fraud unit into the BCA, was to combat fraud. So that was my understanding. So I'm confused on why we're putting this money there when I think we should be putting it into the BCA fraud unit.
Thank you. Attorney General, did you want to comment?
Can
on
we
that?
Clarify?
Please.
Yeah. First of all, Representative, I definitely appreciate you asking these questions. These are good questions, asked clearly and in good faith. And I'll let Nick weigh in on this one, but I will say the structure of the grant is, again, it's a national program in every AG's office in the country. And so and everybody's required to do a match, including us. And we're just saying, if we want more people to do more fraud control, then the state has to do more investment, just like everybody else, Texas, Idaho, that's just how the program is set up. But the thing is that, as you know, yeah, law enforcement does a lot, if you've ever watched Law and Order, first the cops go in, then the prosecutors come in. We're the prosecutors, and you know that, but I'm just for everybody else's edification. We still need to do investigations sometimes, and we still get the referral from the agency. So, Nick, do you want to elaborate at all?
Mr. Yeah. Blanca.
So, to get into the technical piece of this, in order for us to have federal financial participation in this, these investigators, the money that you are dedicating to, they need to be employed by the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Federal regulations require that. They also require that any unit employee devotes their time exclusively to the work of the Medicaid Fraud Unit. It's like how the Attorney General said, we can't take this money and have people moonlight elsewhere in something. And finally, any Medicaid fraud investigator or other unit employee has to be under the direction and supervision of the unit director, who's me. If you give this money to the BCA, they would certainly not be under my direction, and you would be essentially getting four and a quarter instead of the 18 people that we are funding here. Additionally, our investigators are like every state across the country that has a Medicaid fraud unit, they are separate from the statewide police force, right? Nearly every state, as you know, probably has a statewide police force like the BCA, and they work in conjunction, right? The BCA investigates all type of fraud. Child care fraud, food fraud, other things. Our investigators are exclusively Medicaid fraud, and that allows them to develop specialized expertise in some of these areas, whether it's reviewing healthcare records, comparing them to claims for reimbursement, learning CPT codes, learning about what is qualified supervision, right? What's the difference between a qualified professional or a qualified supervising professional? These are things that they have to know and be able to ask on the ground with their questions that allows them to develop that expertise. And this isn't to say that the BCA couldn't. The BCA is great. We work with them quite a bit. Tony Offset has a great team over there. But giving this money here gets you more bang for your buck, and it gets you that specialized expertise.
All right. And I'm going to go to the next member. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, and I have a question too. So, but we were kind of hoping to get done like in the next 5 minutes. We'll see how that goes. But if everybody could just be concise, it would be helpful. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few questions on the new language and the new records that you're asking for, banking and credit, all those things. Are those federally required for you to get this addition of all these different records that you're going to be collecting? Is that a federal requirement to get the dollars, or is that just you think it's best to do this to enhance the investigation?
Mr. Wonka, do you want to take that?
Are you talking about the subpoena power?
Yes.
So the subpoena power, there's no federal requirement that we get bank records, but to prove a crime of fraud, we need to obtain bank records to prove that the defendant who we're prosecuting obtained the Medicaid money, right? Like, that's how we prove the fraud, and that's how we investigate others. We often see in our investigations that you may have somebody who is named as the owner, but is actually paying a person who is not disclosed on provider enrollment documents. And we often uncover that through financial records. So this subpoena authority would allow us to much more quickly and easily obtain financial records than we can right now.
Chair Scott?
Thank you. So it's kind of a speed thing. You're getting those records now. It's just a more time-consuming effort to get them, okay?
That's right.
A question on the venue. So you're saying you're speaking about the counties where the offense took place and all that. Is that just Minnesota counties, or can you go to Cook County, Illinois, to collect on this? You can't cross state lines.
Mr. Wonka?
We cannot prosecute a crime that occurs in another state. And we cannot venue a county in the state of Illinois. We cannot venue a criminal case prosecuted by the state of Minnesota in the state of Illinois and have it tried in an Illinois court.
Chair Scott?
So what, thank you, Madam Chair. So if you have information that would lead you to think that the money is being transferred to somebody in Cook County, Illinois, do you alert the Illinois folks then, or what do you do?
Mr. Wonka?
So the venue provision relates to where a case is charged. It doesn't relate to where we can get financial records from. When we learn that financial money is being moved to another bank in another state, there are ways that we can recapture that money under what's called an attachment order. That's in a separate statute. We're not looking to amend that, but that's what we do there. So I will say if we learn that criminal activity is occurring in another state, we would certainly alert the Illinois MFUCU, but this venue provision, that doesn't relate to financial records and where we can get them from.
Chair Scott?
Last question. Sorry, Madam Chair. So I know this is for 18 additional FTEs. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so what this tells me, if you're wanting 18 more FTEs, it's telling me that the fraud goes way deeper than maybe it is suspected, that you need 18 more people to find the fraud. And so for that reason, I mean, I'll support the bill, but I think that speaks volumes to how much fraud we're actually looking at in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, can I respond?
AG, yeah. Please.
So you are right in that we do need 18 more people, but part of that is driven by, remember I was saying there is a CMS, correct me if I go wrong, does an audit of every program around the country and compares us. And they have told us, given some of the increases that are in overall activity, we think your program is too small and should grow based on the metrics that we have compared to all MFUCU programs in every state. So, yeah, there's way too – we've got to combat fraud. You're right. I agree with you. But it is based on the national audit telling us that compared to others, you're prosecuting a lot of cases, but you also are doing it with a lesser number of people than would be indicated by the volume of cases that you're prosecuting. And we can show you the report if you'd like to see it. We'd be more than happy for you to read it. In fact, it would be great for you to read it so that you would know that what we're telling you is accurate. So do you want to add anything on?
Mr. Wonka.
No, so the size of state Medicaid fraud control units are determined in part by the size of the state Medicaid budget. When we went up to 32 people in 2019, the state Medicaid budget was, I believe, $13 billion. Now it's $21 billion, which is, we are on pace to even go higher than that, and that's why we have the need for increased people. In addition, our referrals have steadily gone up. These are from DHS, MCOs, occasionally from law enforcement. 2019, when we went up to 32 people, we had 144 unique referrals. Last year, we had over 200. This federal fiscal year, which started on October 1st, to today, we are already exceeding what we got all of last federal fiscal year. We're already over 200 referrals from DHS, managed care organizations, and law enforcement. So there is still a lot of fraud that needs to be investigated and prosecuted, which is why we are asking for these increased number of people. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Next we have, Hudson, Duran, and Curran. So Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. Just to try to put some context around the questions that you're hearing, I think what's happening is we're looking at this from a design perspective. So I keep hearing you talk about what federal grants require, what's required of the Medicaid fraud unit. And there's no dispute about that, the scale and nature of the problem, no dispute about that. I think where we're coming from here and the reason why you're hearing similar questions asked about the potential of moving this to another agency such as the BCA is because the scale of the problem has gotten to such a point that we're questioning whether the initial design of how this unit was implemented is adequate to what we're seeing on the ground. You just talked about the increased budget over a relatively short period of time and how and the increased number of referrals. And so the question I have is, does federal law require that these investigators be in your office, or is it possible to conform with the requirements of the grant and have the Medicaid fraud unit in a different state agency?
Attorney General.
Thank you for the question, Representative. Yeah, for the purposes of this grant, they have to be in the Attorney General's office, as they are in every other state. But I'm glad you asked about design, because there are some design questions to be asked. I don't know if this is the forum, but I'd be more than happy to talk to you about that in another time.
Thank you. Representative Hudson? Okay. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You brought up a really good point earlier, Mr. Ellison, about political divides. And I think one of the worst things we can do is make our law enforcement political, especially people who are actually charging out things. But you've also done that yourself, though. You've created a divide between the Republicans and the Democrats yourself. So when we talk about investing money into things that we want done, we want to make sure that we as a party are investing money into, you know, things that we want done, like holding our own accountable as well. You know, so there's a lot of fraud within, you know, our agencies, but who has allowed that fraud to happen? Why did it go on? So can you tell me, I guess, what are you reassuring us as a body, as elected officials here, that you are actually going to maybe hold our own accountable as well, but not really make this a political issue, but make this an actual right and wrong issue? Because one of the worst things we do as politicians is we create this divide within the people that are supposed to be charging out these things. And so right now we have a politician that's charging out these things that is going to be swayed one way or the other. We might not necessarily agree with how things are done, but yet you want us to invest into your department while tearing us down at the same time. I find that very concerning, but I want to make sure that we as the Republican Party are getting what we pay for as well, because we owe that to our taxpayers. We owe that to our constituents that we're getting what we pay for. So what reassurance are you going to give us that if we give you this money, that you're going to hold people accountable? I know that there's a lot of stuff that's going on out there, a lot of wind about a recording and you and other people and receiving money and everything else that creates doubt. So as the person that's in charge of this organization that's we're going to be investing a lot of money into, how do we as the people get the assurance that you're going to do the right thing?
And before the AG answers that, Representative Duran, I just want to say that we're not here to make sure that the Republican Party or the DFL party gets anything. This is about the taxpayers of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota. So I'm going to let the AG answer, but we're all politicians too, by the way, in case you haven't noticed, not just the AG. We all run for election, and elections are coming. So, you know, I know that the heat is here. We're a very political body, but I think that the accusation is a little bit out of bounds, but I'm going to allow the AG to answer.
Representative, let me assure you that when I'm talking to voters, I tell them what I believe in and what I'm going to work for. After the election's over, I basically do my best to fulfill the promises that I made on the campaign trail. But that's, for me, where the politics ends. You have not and will never hear one member of my staff ever say, do this for the Republicans, do this for the red districts, don't do it for the blue. I don't do that. I don't do those things. I would not agree that I'm as that I've created political divide. What I would agree on is that I have a good faith belief in certain things that I pursue and work on. As it relates to other things you've said, you know, there's a time and place for all of that. What I can assure you, here's what I can absolutely promise you, that we will do our absolute best to protect the public dollar in the state of Minnesota in health care fraud programs and Medicaid fraud. That's what we'll do. We don't have original jurisdiction over everything. So, for example, we don't have original jurisdiction over whistleblowers, for example. I don't have a legal basis to do that. If I started pursuing things that I don't have a right to pursue, you'd say, hey, Ellison, you're pursuing, you're exceeding your legal authority. And you'd be right if I were to do that. What I'm telling you is, you support this bill. Anybody who steals public programs, money from Medicaid program in Minnesota, will face justice if that case is referred to my office or if it gets the attention of my office. And it will not be, and we will never ask the question, Republican, Democrat, Green Party, Independent, don't care, right? So, you know, there's a lot of people who have their own political ideas, but if they're endowed with a public trust, they do their job to the best of their ability without regard to politics. I'm telling you, that's what I strive to do. You and I can meet for coffee to talk about the rest of it some other time.
Thank you. Anything further, Representative Duran?
No, I'm good.
My offer is open, and I'm sincere about that.
All right, Representative Curran. Representative Duran, you don't have the floor now. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a couple questions for the bill author. This hearing is quite different from our hearing in Human Services that was very much centered around the horrible people stealing Medicaid funds and the wonderful people that it's supposed to be going to. I would hope that we could center back to that because that's the issue that we are all here to tackle together. And Rep. Norris, it's my understanding that Minnesota has in the ballpark of $20 million of the Medicaid budget. I see you nodding, so I'm not going to pause for the. And I know there are other states, you know, same program because this is a federal program. So if we look at other states who have in the ballpark of $20 million, same funding that they're having to go through to investigate potential fraud cases, we're asking for 18 more people. Can you give us a breakdown of what other states' capacity is? You know, how many people does Minnesota have? How many people do other states have to keep up with the sort of national trends that we're seeing?
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative Kern for the question. Yeah, we can look at other states and really get an objective measure of the budget and how many staff we've got in our state. So, as you mentioned, looking at states with similar Medicaid budgets, we've got 32 staff right now. Take Indiana, they've got 59 staff. Washington has 57 staff. So roughly same budget in both those states for their Medicaid budget and almost twice as many staff. You look at a state like Virginia, roughly the same budget again. They've got 92 staff in their Medicaid fraud control unit, so almost three times as many. And so, you know, red states, blue states, it's clear that, you know, there's a need as our Medicaid budget grows in this state for us to invest the resources to ensure program integrity. And when people violate the law, they are prosecuted and held accountable.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Norris. I appreciate your work in making sure that Minnesota is keeping up with other states. I think this bill, we could argue that it maybe doesn't go far enough to get more folks who are dedicated, because the more people we have dedicated to stopping fraud in Minnesota, the faster that we're going to stop fraud in Minnesota. And because this is a federal program with so many parameters around it that we have to follow. I'm shocked to learn that Minnesota we're only working with 32 and other states have 90 or 90 plus. I really appreciate that. This is absolutely a problem that all states are dealing with. Unfortunately, Minnesota is one of them, and I'm glad we're doing something about it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Curran. I don't know if you wanted to say anything more. So I do have a question as well, and it has to do with the restitution piece. And I heard during the presentation that Minnesota court has said that you can't do this, and so you're changing it in statute. I don't know if maybe I misheard, but I wondered if one of our three lawyers up there could help me understand. My question about the restitution is, you know, you're going after restitution from something you didn't charge for whatever reason, but that is related to a conviction. And can you just reassure me that this comports with due process, that there's no problem doing this? Because it does give me a little bit of heartburn, I have to say.
Yes.
Mr. Wonka.
So it does. That's why there's a notice provision here. The state has to provide notice to the defendant that it is seeking this other restitution, and it still maintains the burden of proving that restitution during any hearing. The defendant has the same ability to challenge that restitution through a process that is otherwise confined in law. What the state of the law is right now is that our appellate courts have said you cannot get restitution unless it is part of a charged or convicted case. That slows our ability to charge stuff, right? Like if we have 10 years worth of fraud and we want to get a case out the door so that we can hold this person accountable, investigating 10 years of fraud, 10 years of claims for reimbursement, comparing it to 10 years of healthcare provider records, interviewing 10 years worth of providers, recipients, to ensure that you can capture every dollar, that is very time consuming. It differentiates us from what is currently in federal law that allows them to move quicker. And so this restitution provision would, if we get to, say, a five-year offense, we've investigated 5 years of it, we have evidence that it has occurred even longer than that, this will allow us to capture that fraud that goes back even further and have it repaid to the state. If we provide notice to the defendant of what we're seeking, we are specific about why we are seeking it, it is related conduct, and the state proves it up at a restitution hearing. So the due process being notice and an opportunity to be heard, that will be assured in this bill by the notice provision that we wrote in.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that explanation. That makes a lot of sense. You know, the thing that kind of worries me is like, why are you not charging something? Is it because you don't have the evidence? And then having people, you know, be charged for, have to pay essentially a huge fine with a lower standard of proof. But I appreciate that, and I trust that this is something that would be used very judiciously to not, you know, and appropriately in a way that you've just described it. So thank you for that. So finally, I just want to say thank you very much for coming to testify today. I especially wanted to say to Mr. Wonka that as a state employee who's doing this work on our behalf, we really appreciate you and the people that you are supervising and the work that you do. And, you know, we often don't really interact with and know the people that are doing this work. And just know that we get that it's very difficult. And, you know, that we have people working for us in the AG's office and elsewhere who could probably have more lucrative jobs elsewhere and choose to be public servants and do this work on all our behalf. So thank you so much for that. And with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2354 be referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3621, Representative Cleavorn. Right. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Since Representative Cleavorn is not on the committee, so the chair will move House File 3621, and it is going to be referred to the General Register. Is that right, Representative Cleavorn?
That is correct.
All right. Thank you. And there is an A2 amendment, and I know this is Chair Scott's amendment, but Representative Cleavorne, are you okay with us taking that up and just adopting it, or do you want to discuss it first?
I just have a quick question for Mr. Hopkins, please.
I'm sorry, for who?
For Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Hopkins, okay. Mr. Hopkins, go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. Mr. Hopkins, as you know, on the A2 amendment, lines 1.2 and 1.3 were adopted in state government finance, and the bill has been engrossed since that time. So my question is, I would like to accept lines 1.4, 1.5, and 1.6, which are the new pieces to be amended. We're working off in the committee today because the engrossment wasn't done at the time that you did it. I'm just trying to figure out how this actually works. So I don't know if we need to divide the A2 amendment, because I agree totally with everything on the page.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that we're following the proper process.
All right. Why don't we do this, Representative Cleavorne? Why don't you go ahead and present the bill as it is, or, you know, you can, and then we'll give Mr. Hopkins a couple of minutes to figure that out, and then we'll deal with the amendment.
Perfect.
That's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I will have to say that House Research has done an excellent job on the summary of the bill. So this bill would modify a law that was enacted and allowed temporary payments to be withheld at the level of a preponderance of the evidence. House File 3621 would make several changes to the current law. It lowers the standard of proof from preponderance of evidence to credible allegation. It expands the definition of program participant to individuals as well as legal entities where there is a subject of a credible allegation of fraud. When an individual or entity is participating in multiple state agency or programs, House File 3621 allows other agencies to also withhold payment when one of the agencies determines that there's a credible allegation of fraud. The bill also eliminates the program's participant's ability to appeal the agency's withholding in the Court of Administrative Hearings, but allows an administrative reconsideration. I have with me today the general counsel for MMB as well as Mr. Moore. And I brought them because I am not an attorney, and I know that the members of this committee ask really difficult questions. So I want to make sure that we have the true legal clarification for any member of this committee who might have it. So with that, I would ask that we just move on to the amendment or to members' questions.
Okay, well, I think Mr. Hopkins is still working on to try to figure out the amendments. So. Welcome. Did either of these two gentlemen want to say anything about the bill, or
I believe
just
they're
here
for technical expertise.
Okay. All right. So, are there any questions from members? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this bill. I'm on board with it. I'm also a little curious as to a couple of the provisions. Mm-hmm. Cross-agency withholding. So it says that they can withhold payment or that they shall in that preponderance of evidence.
In which line
Chair
are you
Cleavorne.
Looking at?
I'm sorry, I'm looking at a brief. Let me.
Are you looking at lines 5.3?
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to address that? Mr. McNulty.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Representative,
and
I believe the standard is...
Could you state your name?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
My name is Chris McNulty, General Counsel for Minnesota Management and Budget.
Thank you. Please,
thank you.
Please proceed.
The standard is May, and so the expectation is that upon sharing of the information of potentially concerning or fraudulent activity at one agency, that could be sent to another agency where that agency would then have to do its own assessment as to whether or not that is a credible allegation of fraud for programs within its own oversight.
Representative Engen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That seems like it would it should be a shall. If there's one credible instance of fraud beyond the preponderance of evidence in one state agency, we should be shutting off that money faucet in all state agencies, not allowing that to continue. I believe that there's been several instances of feeding our future defendants who are up even a couple months ago were still getting paid by the state. So that shouldn't happen, and anything that we can do to extend that and strengthen it, give it some teeth, I'd be really grateful.
Thank you.
Chair Cleburne, did you want to respond?
No, I've taken note. Thank you.
Okay. I mean, the only thing I wonder, based on that, Representative Engen, I mean, there might be times when it might not be wise to do that because you'd be tipping somebody off, would you not? I mean, maybe they are going to, I don't know if I'm just thinking about how this might work, but if the agency has to suspend payment as soon as they have a credible allegation, would that perhaps interfere sometimes with an investigation? I don't know. I mean, Chair Cleburne?
Chair Liebling, please keep in mind that we have lowered the standard of evidence, right? So when you lower the standard of evidence, innocent individuals could be swept up to a concern that a member of our side of the aisle may have. So we want to make sure that before we say shall, that we know that this entity is truly guilty of. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so I want to be careful about this, but that would be my recommendation.
Mr. McNulty or Mr. Moore, did either of you want to comment on that piece?
Absolutely, Chair Liebling. That is, I believe, correct, in that there is this allegation of fraud that allows the triggering of the withholding of the payments. While that is being undertaken, there is a process in place for the agency in question to conduct an internal assessment, investigation. The entity in question has the right under the new language to an administrative reconsideration. And so, again, the sharing of that information, that's for the purpose of that every agency is aware of what's going on at other agencies involving the common program participants, so that sometimes there may be concurrent investigations. Likewise, of course, there may be a situation where if the administrative reconsideration period is complete, where the agency determines absolutely there is fraud going on here, then of course they can share that information with other agencies as well and say, we've completed our investigation. And obviously I think that information would then be taken into consideration by other agencies and used, you know, in an appropriate manner.
Okay. Anything further, Representative Engen?
Sorry, Madam Chair, I'll be super quick. So it's my understanding that right now there's a required notice within 5 days detailing the reasons without compromising an investigation. So if there's credible and found fraud within one state agency, it seems pretty common sense that we would also turn off the spigot elsewhere, despite all the reasons as to why you listed otherwise. Is that my understanding? Why wouldn't we go beyond that?
Well, upon the receipt of a credible allegation of fraud, the other agency is empowered to turn off the payments.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that they are empowered, but they should be mandated to be empowered. That's my assertion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Curran. Thank you, Chair. And as we're, again, in the Human Services Committee, we've had a lot of discussion about this. And some of the stories that have come out where there's been complaints of fraud or alleged fraud, there have been, again, I know this bill would pertain to any state agency. My focus is on how are people receiving services and are they receiving the services they need if they're vulnerable, right? And so how this has played out, the way that the current Department of Human Services in Minnesota has done it, is the credible allegation of fraud to the OIG and their department, they've considered a complaint to be credible. So anyone who has any information about anything, including a vendetta against an employer they got fired from, could make a complaint and totally shut off funds to an entire organization that maybe supports hundreds of people with developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. That's the concern that I have when we're using language like this that is so broadly applicable. I, you know, not to diminish the concern, but the what we have seen actually happen is that there were allegations of fraud. The OIG got involved, payments were withheld, and months went by before anyone actually stepped foot into the place to make sure they were, you know, to check to see if they were committing fraud. And so, you know, then by then, some people have gone homeless, some providers have closed. In one case, there was a provider who had a credible allegation of fraud. By law, they're able to, if their funding is cut off, they have a right to give that person 60 days notice before they shut off their services. And places can't afford to send staff for free, and staff aren't going to work for free with no paycheck coming. So what we have seen happen is, unfortunately, there was an allegation of fraud. The program had to stop. People stopped showing up to care for somebody, and the next time someone saw that person, they had died. And it's really unfortunate that I have to bring this up in committees, and this isn't about you. This is about the fact that, you know, this is like one of the worst outcomes that the state could possibly be responsible for in its pursuit to find fraudsters. And I don't want that baked into our laws. So that would be my concern moving forward. And I guess my question then for a testifier is, how does this language in this bill, does it make any changes or codify what the Department of Human Services has been doing? Does it direct the Department of Human Services to do what they have been doing? Does it touch them in any way?
Mm-hmm. Mr. McNulty, did you want to address that?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative Curran. The purpose of this bill is to expand the authority that is very similar to that is already held by DHS to the enterprise. And so there is language in this bill, and thank you, line 6.3 to 6.5, that specifically says this does not supersede any other authority. And that was put there deliberately because we are aware with the current language in 15.013 that DHS has had issues where various program participants who are having their payments withheld under DHS's specific authority, which is 245.095 subdivision 5, for the record, that these program participants are saying that they are entitled to an administrative appeal at the Court of Administrative Hearings, which is subject to Chapter 14, which can be quite time-consuming, and that DHS has had to explain this and defend this in court to say no, 15.013 does not apply here. We have our own authority. And so just to avoid any question as to whether or not, you know, 15.013 or DHS's specific authority applies, that part of the bill was added. This does not require DHS to use this language, although it is very similar. DHS and the other agencies, such as DCYF, are still able to use their own authorities.
Representative Curran? Thank you, Chair, and thank you. So is it my understanding then, folks who are in the human services realm, would they still have the ability for an appeals process if this language passes?
I'm sorry, the ability to?
Would they still have the ability for that appeals process if this bill passes, mm-hmm. Do people lose their ability for an appeal?
No. If this bill passes, the under DHS programs where they're using DHS authority, their right to administrative reconsideration remains the same.
Representative Curran. That answers my question. Thank you so much.
All right, good. And I just want to note for the record that we have received a new copy, and that is the first engrossment. So, Mr. Hopkins, do you want to just, I think maybe we're ready to move the amendment, right? Chair Scott, do you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I'm glad to have the right engrossment here. So what happened is in the previous committee, the withholding of information and the withholding of those that language in lines 1.2 of the current amendment were already fixed in the previous committee. So the only section, my understanding, would be that we need the page 6, line 15, to delete the and withholding of payments to make it consistent. But I will have counsel clarify that, but we still need to maybe, I'll let counsel clarify.
So, Mr. Hopkins.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, so there are a few changes to be made to the A2 amendment to reflect that it's amending the first engrossment and to do that properly. The point of the amendment is to continue this process that began in the last committee of making clear that the withholding of payments is not necessarily clarified as confidential or protected non-public data under subdivision 3. So there's a series of oral amendments to the A2 amendment that will reflect that.
Okay, so Chair Scott, do you know what those are? Do you want to, or let Mr. Hopkins state
please.
What those
yes,
would be?
Yes.
So this has been, so the A2 has been moved, and Mr. Hopkins.
Excuse me, before we begin, I think Chair the Cleveland. Statement that was made is not completely accurate. On the A2, I see line 1.4, 1.5, and 1.6. Those all need to be done in this committee. Okay.
Yeah, so we're about to take care of that.
Oh, perfect. I wanted to make sure that I thought 1.4 was not included in
that. Well, Mr. Hopkins is going to suggest some oral amendments to the amendment that's before us so we can get it in the right shape. Mr. Hopkins.
Yes, Madam Chair, the one additional change would be at page 5, line 6, and this is at page 5, line 6 of either the first engrossment or the as introduced version, so take your pick from your printout, where it says notwithstanding subdivision 3. That can also be stricken because that anticipated the withholding of payments being classified as confidential. That paragraph allows the state agency to send a notice of withholding of payments to the program participant. It does not need to notwithstand subdivision 3 if that data is not classified as confidential. So that's
So, Mr. Hopkins, if I'm understanding that, why don't we do this? If we can amend the, if there are oral amendments to the A2, let's take those, and then this additional change could just be an oral amendment, a separate oral amendment. Can we do it that way? Would that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense.
Okay, so if you could give us, tell Chair Scott what she needs to do to amend the A2 to get it in the shape that would work for the
sure.
bill.
Madam Chair, the oral amendments to the A2 amendments are the following. Page 1, line 1, after 3621, insert the first engrossment. Page 1, delete lines 2 and 3.
Okay, did everybody get that? So on your A2 amendment, we're going to insert the first engrossment after the bill number, because that's what we're working off of. And the oral amendment would be to delete 1.2 and 1.3 because those are already in the engrossment, don't need to be redone, correct? So that would be Chair Scott's oral amendment to her amendment, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. So all in favor of those, are there any questions about that oral amendment to the written amendment? Okay. There being none, all in favor of adopting those amendments to the A2, please say aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails. And so we have the amended A2 before us. So Chair Scott, would you want to speak to your A2 as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair. So what we've arrived at in our conversations is that the payment withholding piece, first of all, this was negotiated last year. If you remember, we had a bill in regular session that addressed this issue, and it arrived safely after a regular session, and then in special session, somehow in a different chapter or a different area of Chapter 13, this payment withholding information, as you see it, the stricken language where it says that the agency may disclose, that was snuck in somewhere in special session. And so what we're doing here is remedying that and putting it back to the original intention of the legislature as it was passed out of regular session. So that's the reason we're here making these changes. And I still haven't determined who snuck those in. But anyway, what we want to make clear is that the withholding of payments, the receiver of those payments and the agency already know that those payments are being withheld. So the only actor in that equation that's not informed about that is the public. And so we're making it clear that just the, by virtue of just the payments are being withheld, that's all we know, that the public is aware of that too. So that's what these that's what this amendment does. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Chair Cleavorn, did you want to speak to the amendment as amended?
Yeah, I would just be very clear to say when changes happen in conference committee, it's not snuck into a bill. I've never snuck anything into a state government bill. So I just want to be perfectly clear about that. But to the A2, I am completely in agreement, and I am happy to have worked with Chair Scott to make this happen. So,
all right. So we are back on the A2 amendment as amended by the oral amendment. So any other discussion to the amendment? Oh, Chair Scott.
Thank you. And I was not in any way accusing you of that. I don't think that it was you. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So all in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. And then just for convenience here and speed, I would move an oral amendment on line 5.6 of the first engrossment in accordance with Mr. Hopkins' suggestion to strike the words notwithstanding subdivision 3. Is that correct, Mr. Hopkins? Just for consistency. Is there any, I see puzzled looks. Mr. Hopkins, do you want to just once again explain what that is? Oh. No, I guess not. Okay, there's no puzzled look. Are there any questions about that amendment? Okay, no questions. Okay, there being no questions, all in favor of adoption of that oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, so we have the bill then in the shape that I think that the committee is comfortable with it, it seems. So any other discussion to the bill as amended? All right, seeing none, Chair Cleavorn, would you like to give us your final word?
I would just like to thank the committee, and most importantly, I would like to thank the nonpartisan staff in the House and the professional state employees who helped us get this bill to where it needed to be so that we have transparency with the public. We are protecting our entities against fraud. And all in all, it is a very good bill, and I ask for your support.
All right. Thank you. So I will renew my motion that House File 3621, the first engrossment, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, testifiers and Representative Cleavorn. Yes, okay. So we're going to call House File 3429, Representative Kraft. And members, we're going to try to, we really want to get this bill finished by 11:45. So that we can, because we do have another bill. So I'm going to really ask members to try to be concise and try to ask our testifiers to be concise. So welcome to the committee, Representative Kraft. So you're not on the committee, so I will move that House File 3429 be re-referred to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. So that is the motion. It is not going right to the floor. So. And there is an author's amendment. Let's see.
A3.
And let's see. And that is the A3 to put the bill in the form that the author would like to discuss it. And let's see, we have that in our packets. And I think probably it would be best to adopt that and then let the author explain it with the amendment. If anyone has any objection to that, I don't see any. So I will move the A3 amendment. All in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So please proceed, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The A3 amendment made some changes to clarify the definition of intelligent speed assist device.
And Representative Kraft, we're having a little trouble understanding you. So if you could talk, it's okay to keep a mask on, but just talk right into the
okay.
mic.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. Yes. A3 amendment clarified definition of an intelligent speed assist device, also clarified how the notice requirement would be, and then rest of the changes were primarily focused on the override function as opposed to specifying it in statute. We're giving some guidance and having it dealt with in rules, rules-making process. So on the bill, this bill is about saving lives and reducing serious injuries, and it comes from the very simple premise that too much speed causes too much death on our roads. About 30% of the death on our roads are primarily caused by speed. In Minnesota, we've averaged 116 speed-related deaths per year for the past 3 years. From a risk perspective, for every 10 miles per hour increase in speed, the risk of dying in a crash doubles. So going from 60 to 80 means a 4 times increase in risk. From a pedestrian risk perspective, at 23 miles per hour, if a pedestrian is hit by a car going 23, there's a 10% risk of death. If that car is going 42 miles per hour, it's a 50% risk. If that car is going 58 miles per hour, it's a 90% risk. Now, while most drivers occasionally exceed the speed limit, research has shown that a small group of high-risk repeat offenders are the greatest danger. A New York study showed that drivers with 10 tickets contributed to deadly crashes at a rate almost 3 times the general population. As the number of tickets climb, that risk rises to 5 to 20x the general population. This pattern of a few repeat offenders causing a disproportionate amount of death and injury is very similar to DWIs. And in fact, it was last year, while working on the ignition interlock bill after the tragedy in my community at Park Tavern, it was then that I learned about intelligent speed assist devices that can provide a somewhat similar function for super speeders that ignition interlock devices do for repeat DWI offenders. At a high level, the bill requires those that drive egregiously fast or habitually speed to have an intelligent speed assist device installed in their car for a period of time that increases with the number of offenses they commit. I think I have a testifier, and then I'll get into bill specifics after that.
All right, thank you. We have Julie Risser. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony. And if you could be brief, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee, Representative Kraft. I'm Julie Risser. January 14th, 2019, a reckless driver killed my nephew, Henry Zietlow. Speed made the crash worse. It's a public health crisis. Now I know this personally. I also serve on Edina City Council. Like all communities, we suffer from traffic violence worsened by high speeds. During my term, the following crashes have occurred. June 16, 2023, a man released for hit and run exited 35W over 100 miles per hour, crashing into a car on Lake Street, instantly killing 5 young women, all active in their communities, loved, talented, eager to start health and education careers. Sabrina Lee, an Edina High School graduate, just 17. September 1st, 2024, a drunk driver sped into the Park Tavern patio, killing 2 people, injuring at least a dozen. One, Edina High School graduate Theo Larson, an emergency room nurse who lost his colleague, Gabe Harvey, and suffered serious brain trauma. Also, a young man who I saw growing up, he was my neighbor. June 14th, 2025, 18-year-old Finn Cronin, seriously injured street racing. Minnesota Department of Transportation cameras recorded drivers going 100 miles per hour. Finn died 2 weeks later from an Edina family. High-speed crashes devastate loved ones. I got the call at an MCAD faculty lunch. I walked away from a table into exhibit space. There, my world changed. There's been a crash. We lost Henry. Words caused physical change. I disassociated. Details forever with me. The carpet pattern, the gray concrete, my hand floating up to tap a colleague's shoulder. How was it moving? I had to leave, but I was in no shape to drive. Henry, my nephew, 18, home from Bowdoin College, a skilled violinist, champion rower, and science fair standout. He also had a sense of humor. The last time I saw him was Christmas Day. He wore pajamas to the family gathering. I was driving down Wooddale, following the 25-mile-per-hour limit. A kid with a hockey stick suddenly sailed in front of my car on rollerblades, chasing a tennis ball. I could stop. He was okay. Too many speed endangering us all. Please pass House File 3429. It will make Minnesota roads safer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. and we're very sorry for your loss. It's terrible. Are there members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, not seeing any. Representative Kraft, do you want to go ahead and maybe walk through a little more?
Yes.
You said you wanted to present
yes.
more.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to point out that if people have questions on the technology, how it works, the viability of it, Office of Traffic Safety Director Mike Hansen is here, and he's pretty well-known authority on this stuff, so we can always ask him to come up. But I'm going to go a little bit more towards what the bill is doing. A key point on the technology, though, is it isn't new. Commercial fleets have been using it for 30 years. It works, and it's actually less complicated than the ignition interlock. There's no ongoing calibration like with ignition interlock. I do want to point out for you the, because I think this committee is probably interested in it, the location tracking part of the bill, which is Section 6, Subdivision 3, Lines 77 to 722. I spent a lot of time going through this with advocates, with our experts, to have something that I think is where there's strong data protections. So, for example, in this, the providers that provide this service can't share location tracking data with anyone, including the commissioner, without a court order. Providers can't identify program participants with any quality control data that they collect. Providers can't sell data. This is in a slightly different portion. It's in 7.1 to 7.3. With that, I think I'd rather, given your limited time, I can open it up for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kraft. So are there member questions? I have one. I'll get started, and then we'll get everybody on the list here. But Representative Kraft, on line 7.21, it says, services provided by a provider under this section are not a government function for purposes of Section 13.05, Subdivision 11. I didn't have a chance to look up what that subdivision is, but maybe Mr. Hopkins could help me with that and tell me exactly what that means.
Yes, Madam Chair, so Section 13.05, Subdivision 11 is the privatization subdivision. It provides that if a government entity enters into a contract with a private entity to perform any government function, that private entity is subject to Chapter 13 as if it were a government entity. So this says that the provider under this bill is not subject to that subdivision, so the provider is not subject to the Government Data Practices Act.
So, Mr. Hopkins, what is the – well, let me ask the author of the bill, Representative Kraft, so what is the – tell me kind of what that does in the context of this bill to exempt these providers from having to disclose data as though they were government. That's essentially what I understood Mr. Hopkins to say.
Madam Chair, I have to admit I went through this when we created the bill. Might ask if Ben Johnson would be able to talk about this, because I think this is a similar function that's in the ignition interlock, and we patterned it after that.
Sure. So. Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, my memory of the purpose of this was to exempt them from the Government Data Practices Act because there are more specific requirements within the bill in terms of how they are to handle the data that they do collect. So the requirements that are in here related, for example, to not selling the data, to disassociating the individual data from any data they need to make determinations in terms of updating their systems and that sort of quality control check is different from the requirements in the Government Data Practices Act. And so the goal was to avoid any conflicts between the Government Data Practices Act because the provision should be controlled within this section.
Thank you. Okay, other members. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this bill. I think it's great. I had a follow-up question to Chair Liebling's, and so maybe nonpartisan might need to answer this as well, but what is a penalty then for a violation if a provider that has this data does disclose it inappropriately? What would the penalty be?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, there is since it's not directly tied to Chapter 13, those Chapter 13 provisions wouldn't apply. However, there are provisions in here that require the commissioner to essentially approve providers, and those providers are required to follow the standards established by the commissioner, which include the specific things in the statute. So if a provider failed to follow that, then the commissioner, in this case it's the commissioner of public safety, could tell them they could no longer serve as a provider and they would no longer be able to have that business.
Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that explanation. That provides me a little comfort. I think we might want to consider having them subject to at least the penalties, the civil and criminal penalties provision of Chapter 13, in addition to having that explanation that you just gave. And then I do have a question, Representative Kraft, just for how this operates in a very high level. So I don't know that you'll need your technical expert, but I know in my car, if I'm going the speed limit on the highway and I go by over under a bridge or something that has a lower speed limit, my car thinks I'm speeding because it's posted, it's picking up the sign that's somewhere else, not on the highway. So I'm just curious how this technology functions to avoid that kind of situation.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Mohler, my understanding, and we might want to call up Director Hansen, but my understanding is that, kind of like how your, Google Maps knows the speed limit, that's how it addresses it. And if you were to hit another speed limit area, it would require you to slow down. Now, the changes don't happen like automatic, it doesn't hard break or anything like that, but it would then, gradually require you to slow down.
Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then since it's outside of the scope of this committee, I'll maybe talk to you offline about some other questions I have. Thank you.
All right, thanks. And I'm glad you asked that first question because actually it doesn't give me that much comfort. I'd also like to see those penalties be put into the bill or something a little stronger. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. thank you, Representative Kraft. What's the cost for the individual for this? That's going to be a huge concern because some of the individuals might not be able to, afford this.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the service doesn't exist yet, so I can't give you exactly what it would be. But if you look at what Ignition Interlock is, and this is less complex than that, Ignition Interlock fees generally range from $100 to $200 a month. There's also an interlock recalibration fee that doesn't have to happen with this. So I would anticipate something less than those ranges. If there's someone who is not able to pay, is indigent in there, there's a requirement that there be a discount for them, and it says it needs to be at least as good as the Interlock program, and the Interlock program has about a 50% discount.
Representative Duran.
Yep. Thank you for that, Madam Chair. my last question to you would be, have you spoken to the State Patrol or your local law enforcement in regards to possibly picking up the extra patrols around these areas if you have a designated area that's speeding, because that's already a service that we're providing with taxpayer money, right? That we want the officers to be there to hinder these people from, wanting to speed, or, that presence alone is a big thing here. And that's why having these relationships with our local law enforcement is crucial. So have you spoken with, State Patrol to see how many of these speeds or these designated areas that are designed that are having problems with these speeds? Like, have you worked with your local law enforcement to increase the extra patrol in there?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. So at various points since I've been in the legislature and before that on city council where we've had speeding issues in St. Louis Park, I have absolutely worked with my local law enforcement to address it. The thing about this bill is the idea with it is if someone has demonstrated that they are a significant speeder or habitually speed, that then this would create the situation where for them to get their license back after it was revoked for being convicted of this, they would have to put one of these on their car. It would prevent them from speeding. So it's a little bit of a different approach. It says someone that has demonstrated a higher risk and an activity that can cause death, that we're going to say, you know what, from a public safety perspective, if they're going to drive again for a period of time, they should have one of these on their cars to actually prevent them from doing the risk that they've already demonstrated they're willing to do.
Representative Durand, anything further? Okay. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, where did this bill come from?
Representative Kraft? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, I believe I described it in my initial testimony where I said I initially learned about these when I was doing the interlock bill last year, and I started working on it at that point, and I started reaching out to various folks that are stakeholders and things in it. So started it last year.
Yeah. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's something that came out of your head, and you didn't get it from another organization. That's fine. I have a question for you. So we already have reckless driving statutes on the books, which I believe, and maybe staff could correct me if I'm wrong, or our local law enforcement is here. That's already an option. If somebody's caught going 20 miles an hour over a speed limit and it's in a situation that's dangerous, our local law enforcement officers at that time can already charge a reckless driving under that circumstance, can't they?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Bliss, I'm not an expert on reckless driving statutes, but if one exists, then this does not change the ability to charge someone under that. This focuses on what it does is it says, look, we're going to revoke your license. If a license is revoked, what data has shown is that about 75% of people with a license revoked drive anyway. And so what we're doing here is we're saying, look, we want to focus on public safety and address the issues that we're seeing. So that, look, if you're going to drive on it, here's a path to drive, but you have to do it with one of these devices. The other thing that this does is, as we did with the ignition interlock, it says if you're supposed to be on it and you drive anyway, we've raised it from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor.
Just a couple more.
All right, Representative Briss.
So,
sorry.
I drive out in rural Minnesota, and a lot of areas, for instance, one time I was pheasant hunting in southern Minnesota. There's the end of town is like a bus garage or something. A half mile later, it goes up to 55. No markings. I mean, a half mile down the road, it goes up to 55. I was nailed for going 25 over the speed limit at that time. Mm-hmm. I slowed down through town like I was supposed to. I didn't see a speed limit sign. I was out in the country. There was fields next to me. I just assumed I missed the sign and I sped up. There's also in rural Minnesota a lot of two-lane highways that are 65 miles an hour, and then you come into these small towns that you barely even know they're there, and it drops down to 55. And I know personally, in those small towns, there are cops that sit behind a building and wait for you to go 5 miles an hour over that speed limit and will pull you over and ticket you. Now, you know, the examples that were given by your testifier are heartbreaking, but most of those were either reckless driving or driving 100 miles an hour or faster. That's already covered under statute. I think basically, and to your point of realizing the wrong speed on GPS, there's a section in my drive home for about 8 miles. My GPS says it's 30 miles an hour, but the road signs say 60. It's about 8 miles. And the first time I saw it, I'm like, well, this can't be right. And then I had to drive 30 miles an hour with a bunch of cars tailing me before I actually saw another 60 mile an hour sign. So that in that situation, my speed would be limited to 30 miles an hour through that area. I see this as a huge overreach. Three strikes and you're out on speeding. Even 5 miles and over 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, I think is just way, way too much. And I don't support this bill at all. Thank you. And I request a roll call.
Okay, roll call having been requested. And so we're just about ready to vote. I'm going to give Representative Kraft the final word. And then I just want to remind members that when you vote for a bill in committee to move to another committee, you're not saying, I love this bill, it's in its final form, I'm going to vote for it on the floor. You're just saying, I'm moving it to another committee. Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, appreciate the discussion. I commit to following up on the issues that were raised on the Madam Chair, you represent about some penalties for providers. Happy to do that. The Representative Bliss, I totally appreciate your comments. It's three speedings within 12 months. It's not three whenever. That's what the issue is, three within 12 months. The statistics of why to do this bill, I think, are compelling. I thank the testifier for their stories. There are lives that are impacted by speeding like this. I ask your support to go back to transportation. We can continue to work it. And Representative Bliss, I'm happy to talk to you afterwards and see if there are changes that would mollify some of your concerns. So I ask for your support to send it back to Transpo.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kraft. So I'm going to renew the motion that House File 3429, the first engrossment as amended, be re-referred to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. And the clerk will take the roll, and the chair will vote aye.
Chair Liebling, aye. Chair Scott?
No.
Chair Scott, no. Vice Chair Finke? Finke, aye. Vice Chair Hudson?
No.
Hudson, no. Representative Bliss?
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Curran?
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Duran?
No.
Duran, no. Representative Engen?
No.
Engen, no. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Mahmoud, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Steer?
No.
Steer, no. Representative Van Bingsbergen?
No.
Van Bingsbergen, no.
All right, on a vote of 7-7, the bill does not advance. So thank you, members. All right, thank you, Representative Kraft. So next bill on our agenda is House File 3483, Representative Feist. And while Representative Feist is coming up, her motion is going to be that House File 3483 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. And welcome, Representative Feist, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. So House File 3483 does two things. First, it requires a judicial warrant to enter private property, a domestic violence shelter, school property, or a school bus for purposes of civil immigration enforcement, codifying state and federal constitutional protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. It also codifies the findings of Esparza, a case that found that a judicial warrant is required in order for immigration detainers to be honored. I will address both of these in turn. First, again, this bill requires a judicial warrant to enter private property, and it is codifying state and federal constitutional protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. I personally find this very important to my constituents and our state. I'm aware of at least 5 incidents in my community where ICE agents have broken down doors to homes and entered premises without a judicial warrant. And I would like to read a statement from one of my community members about one of these incidents. In the most traumatic event of that day, 12 cars of agents broke down the door of a Hmong father who is in the legal process of obtaining a green card and who has no criminal record. Close to 50 people watched in horror as ICE broke the door down and went in with large automatic weapons to drag this man from his home in front of his family. Observers could do nothing to stop this violent home invasion as ICE pointed huge guns in the faces of neighbors who had gathered to film and honk their horns. The helplessness of watching the government terrorize innocent people with no fear of the people gathered who were literally filming their crimes is trauma that will haunt us for our years to come. The firepower it took to kidnap one unarmed person is ridiculous. The language in this bill requires a warrant to be signed by a neutral judge to ensure an independent check on law enforcement. Judges determine whether there is sufficient evidence to support probable cause and ensure the warrant scope is narrowly focused to permit only minimal incursions on people's rights. Judicial oversight functions as an essential check on government power. The second thing this bill does is it codifies the findings of Esparza, as I mentioned. That case found that in Minnesota, a judicial warrant is required in order for ICE detainers to be honored. In the Esparza decision, the court found that under Minnesota law, law enforcement agencies cannot hold someone who would otherwise be released from custody because the agency has received an immigration detainer. Federal regulations and subsequent court cases explicitly state that a detainer is a request, not a requirement. It is not mandatory. Minnesota state law does not authorize state and local officials to arrest an individual based on an immigration detainer. Further, Minnesota courts have found that meritless arrests constitute unreasonable search and seizure. From a policy standpoint, collaboration between local and federal law enforcement undermines trust between community and law enforcement, and that's bad for all of us. As the County Attorneys Association wrote earlier this term in a statement to the House on a related bill, quote, local participation in federal immigration enforcement undermines public safety by deterring members of immigrant communities from reporting crimes and participating in the prosecution of those crimes due to fear of immigration consequences, unquote. Notably, the worst of the worst are already in Department of Corrections custody. The DOC does honor ICE detainers, coordinating custody transfer. And I have a spreadsheet of all of those transfers if anyone has questions. Recent examples that were provided by the federal government of lack of collaboration between the DOC and the federal government do not align with the facts and have included names of people who were never in DOC custody, have no court records, and were released from ICE custody or from ICE, released to ICE decades ago. So this bill is not to address situations where people should be detained, are being detained, and are being handed over to ICE. This bill is to address racial profiling and harassment of people with no criminal record. To quote a recent federal court judge in a decision on behalf of a constituent of mine on the use of administrative warrants to detain people, quote, civics lessons to the government. Administrative warrants issued by the executive branch to itself do not pass probable cause muster. This is called the fox guarding the hen house. The Constitution requires an independent judicial officer. And with that, I will turn it over to my expert.
All right, thank you, Representative Feist. So testifier is John Beeler. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, members of the committee. We're testifying today in support of HF 3483. Sections 1 through 4 of this bill should not be necessary. For nearly the entire history of our country and in nearly every area, warrants, as referred to in the Fourth Amendment, were understood to mean judicial warrants, those reviewed by an independent magistrate free from executive branch repercussions if they refuse to approve the warrant. The physical entry of the home is the chief evil against which the wording of the Fourth Amendment is directed. It's from the recent Supreme Court opinion. If the home is seen as the chief evil, then it does not seem a great logical jump to imagine how the founders would also have seen warrantless entry by armed officers into a school bus or into a school.
Could you, Mr. Beeler, could you pull the mic just a bit closer? Thanks.
Yes, Chair. These administrative warrants did not even exist until the 1950s. The use and reliance on these self-governed and self-issued warrants is an affront to our constitutional protections of issuance by a judicial officer, probable cause, and particularity. We are also supportive of Section 5 of the bill, which prohibits detention solely on the basis of immigration warrants or immigration detainers. These detainers are currently unlawful under a Minnesota appellate court opinion in Esparza v. Nobles County, as Representative Feist discussed. A recent advisory opinion by the Attorney General confirms this understanding while also highlighting the need for this codification because the Esparza decision is non-precedential. A detainer is an arrest. The requirements for a valid arrest are defined by the Minnesota Constitution and state statute. These arrests require warrants issued upon probable cause, or they need to meet the requirements for a warrantless arrest as defined in Minnesota statute. Codifying this understanding will save local governments and local law enforcement both litigation expenses and legal fees by clarifying their arrest and detention authority. And just to echo what Representative Feist said, this does not affect detainers while individuals remain in custody. So if an individual is sentenced to 30 days, an ICE detainer that requires transfer during those 30 days is lawful. This bill does not change that. It is the request to hold them for an additional 48 hours beyond that sentence that would be unlawful. It is currently unlawful, and this bill would also codify that. So just like that clarification. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Beeler. Are there member questions, discussion? Oh, I'm sorry, and I should ask, are there other members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So any discussion from members? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. I'm going to request a roll call first off. Can't support it. This would provide more protection against federal law enforcement than we currently enjoy against vandals and thieves. You're trespassing just by doing your job. It's that simple. I don't think we need to belabor the point. Thank you.
And there will be a roll call. Other discussion? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I won't belabor a point either. I really appreciate you taking this bill on, Representative Feist, and I agree it's awful that this is necessary, but I believe it is, and I'm happy to support it. Thank you.
Okay, well, we maybe we'll get done early here today. I guess I would just say thank you for the bill, Representative Feist. I find it really astonishing that anybody would be against this bill because it's codifying existing law, it's writing constitutional protections into statute, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Feist or Mr. Beeler, but I don't think it's really changing anything. We should all be supporting the Constitution. We should all be outraged when, I mean, the Constitution is written, the Bill of Rights is written to protect individuals against government. And so the idea that, oh, they're just doing their jobs, but so they can do whatever because they're just doing their jobs, that is exactly why we have a Constitution. So it is really mind-boggling to me to hear an argument like that. And to me, this should be the easiest vote anybody takes all year. You're defending the Constitution, which we all, by the way, took an oath to do. So thank you for the bill. And with that, the clerk will call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I miss somebody here?
Representative Feist.
Oh, Representative Feist wanted to. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Did you want a final word?
Fiery speech. No, just kidding. I just wanted to say some concluding comments.
Please.
That's okay. Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I really do think that this is kind of a foundational bill that I would love for us all to support. The Fourth Amendment is at the heart of our constitutional protections. I've had really interesting conversations with Republican colleagues about kind of like where like Republican and DFL trust lies, and they're like, we don't trust the government. You trust the government, but we don't. I'm a former board member of the ACLU of Minnesota, so I don't really trust the government either. You know, this is really important right now. You know, the federal government is in the hands of the Republican Party, and maybe that makes you more comfortable with the underlying motives of their actions. But imagine that it's a Democratic president. Imagine that they're coming, you know, for reasons that you do not support. We need to protect ourselves from overreach, and I believe that's what this legislation does. And lastly, just wanted to mention that, you know, one of the reasons that we wrote the Declaration of Independence was specifically because of overbroad warrants and intrusion onto our homes. And so that's what this bill seeks to get at, and I would love your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Sorry about that, almost not letting you have the final word. And I also need to renew the motion. I guess I was so carried away with the issue that I forgot to that you need to renew the motion. So Representative Feist is renewing the motion that House File 3483 be re-referred to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. So clerk will take the roll, and Chair votes aye.
Chair Liebling, aye. Chair Scott?
No.
Chair Scott, no. Vice Chair Finke?
Aye.
Finke, aye. Vice Chair Hudson? No. Hudson, no. Representative Bliss?
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Curran?
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Duran?
No.
Duran, no. Representative Engen?
No.
Engen, no. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Steer?
No.
Steer, no. Representative Van Beemsbergen?
Sorry.
No.
Representative Van Beemsbergen, no. 7-7.
So on a split vote, the bill does not advance. So thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for the bill, Representative Feist. So with that, we are adjourned.